meeting the true Dharma? Or is that we'll find it. May they share with us their compassion, which fills the boundless universe. Compassion filling the boundless universe. Up in the first few lines, there's something about meeting. Well, hear the true Dharma, and that upon meeting it, we will renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma. There we go. The reason that pops out, and compassion filling the universe. Hold those thoughts. We were talking yesterday about Bodhidharma's concept that the seeking mind is suffering. And because it's got this perfume of the ego that wants to attain something nice, inner peace, tranquility, attain an understanding of non-duality, but it's sort of a cash value that the ego can claim then. And I contend, and maybe Dogen does too, that that our practice allows us to meet what comes up. A very different exchange. Meeting the Dharma rather than attaining the truth or attaining inner peace. Yesterday, we talked about the practice period, and especially Sesshin as an opportunity to abide in big mind, in our Buddha nature. That limitless consciousness that is nothing but a boundless universe of compassion, harmony. They talk about the word, or one word that comes up a lot is the purity of big mind, of our Buddha nature. And purity usually has the connotation that there's no kind of bumps that we can identify. There's a homogeneity, that nothing is more valuable than anything else. In fact, it's hard to see any differences. Maybe sitting in our meditation with the wall in front of us, maybe that's an opportunity to really abide in the pure big mind consciousness, without any discrimination, not being able to identify this or that, the sound of the sirens might arise, but it's just a character on that big screen of consciousness that accepts all, rejects nothing. It doesn't hinder or obstruct or put a little scratch in the screen of consciousness. It just arises as nothing but consciousness. We get a chance to really abide there and have confidence that this is our true nature and the source from which we can identify all other things, from which all other things arise. And in Sesshin we get a chance to, the bell rings and we can get up, and with that big mind so forward, so on the front burner in our lives, we can chant and bow just with the idea of being in harmony, being in unity, not being separate with the group that is all cultivating big mind and has nothing but harmony and compassion and intimacy and non-separation as their motivation for any actions during Sesshin. We want to eat quietly, so it's harmonious and not no distinctive sounds coming from utensils on the bowls. It doesn't feel like an admonition, and I hope it didn't sound like that when I said it. It's what our intention is, because all of our movements and all of our gestures and all of our communication is coming out of harmony, compassion, non-separation, non-distinction. So it's something that we intend to do, and all of Sesshin is designed to move, to help this dance between big mind and our ego that comes up when we're asked to chop the carrots and help the tenzo. It's a skill we want to have and cultivate. This body's going to move. We're going to be able to identify the tools we need to do the work. We're going to be able to identify who the work leader is, so that we can get the next chore. So but the motivation of our actions is coming out of big mind that sees only unity, non-separation, no distinction, no value of this or that, only acceptance. So it's this great dance, and it's not such a It's not such a, you don't turn off big mind to go into a small self and chop the carrots. It's this, the word that Edie's got me thinking about, pivot, you know, which is Reb's word. It's just this pivot. It reminds me of, I'll bring in a little sort of drama, a little sad event. But years ago, after an evening sit, and people were gathering for the farewell circle and the announcements, in the middle of the circle, one of our practitioners had a seizure. And luckily there were a couple of health professionals also in the circle, and they knew just what to do. They were the first responders. I was not one of them. I was definitely part of the support staff. The ambulance was called, but the first responders knew what to do until the ambulance came to keep this practitioner as safe as possible. And it wasn't, they didn't, there wasn't a switch between, now I'm a Zen student and then I'm now a health professional first responder. There was just this pivot from, this personal relationship that they had, this individual personal relationship they had with their Dharma sister, to then a bigger relationship with safety and health that was always active in their bodies, even though they could easily pivot between an individual relationship with being able to go to the store and buy groceries and pivot just slightly into being a first responder healthcare professional without changing body, without changing form. It's just that pivot. And because of their training, it was always on the front burner, ready to be used. And that's the dance that we do with, our movement and actions coming out of big mind. And it takes practice like this because I think initially in practice we think that it's sort of a rarefied state that can only be accessed in the kind of quiet, incense-ridden room of a zendo, between two series of bells. I think that's true in the beginning. I think we need all of the causes and conditions of a room such as this and generations of teachers giving lectures such as this to know how to bring, to know how to access, to know how to identify. And I want to give Kokyo that credit for that word that he used in his last talk here, to be able to identify with big mind and Buddha nature as our true self, instead of identifying so much with all these characteristics of Patrick that have risen over 66 years that I've practiced over and over again that are just conditioned. That are stuff that I've just reacted to over the years. And so now I think that's my personality and that's what Patrick really is. But my true self is this limitless consciousness that can meet the world as it arises in the consciousness, and whose actions come out of this consciousness that is nothing but enlightenment, liberation, non-discrimination, non-separation, intimacy, all of those words. We might think of it as another example. If I'm really identifying with big mind, I might on the screen of big mind, I might hear the name Patrick come up, and I might identify, oh, there's something that I've learned to call another human, and she's addressing me as Patrick, and oh, I remember all of those characteristics of Patrick, and if I really want to promote harmony and compassion, I better respond as Patrick, but I'm going to respond with this motivation that this interaction is going to be harmonious and intimate, and let me join that. Let me meet this stimulus as it arises in big mind, and see if it too is nothing but intimacy and compassion and harmony and non-separation. So, we can practice with that kind of play, the kind of play that. That I'm big mind now, and we'll see that when we practice that play over and over, that we've never been anything else but big mind. That it's not something we have to put on or something we have to dig to abide in rarefied conditions such as this, that it's always been right there. So this is our opportunity to really become confident in our true nature, our Buddha nature, our big mind, that can be brought forward, and our actions can come out of that. I contend that Bodhidharma was pointing in this direction. And one of his four practices that lead to the path, and as Dogen would say, four practices that are the path: seeking nothing, people are always longing for something, always, in a word, seeking. but we can wake up. We can fix our minds on the sublime and let our bodies change with the seasons. I like that line. We can identify with our true nature, with our Buddha nature, with our big mind. We can fix our minds on the sublime. And when we do that, we realize that this thing that I've attached to as so important, this body, all these great thoughts and ideas that I practice over and over again, we can see that they are in the realm of coming and going. And we can, they can come and go as they age from 0 to 66. As the seasons change, these bodies put on coats and take off coats. Grow our hair and cut our hair. But it's not when we fix our minds on the sublime, when we identify with our Buddha nature and our big mind, we're seeking nothing. And meeting the world, meeting our life as it comes up. As I said earlier, yesterday, Bodhidharma's a little strict. I've even had to change the language so that I could talk about it. and I think I would be a student of his grand Dharma heir, or maybe Waika, because he was pretty strict. The third practice is seeking nothing. People of this world are deluded. They're always longing. In a word, seeking. They should wise up and choose reason over custom. That's hard language to, but then comes, they fix the ones that do choose reason over custom. Reason, I think, another reason why reason was chosen over and over in this is, of course, Bodhidharma said, this practice points, continuously pointing to the mind. And so I think that's why reason, choosing, reason here means, those who turn the light inward and study the mind in the way that Dogen later said, to study Buddhism is to study the self. I think that's why reason is always chosen here. But those who choose reason, those who seek nothing, are fixing their minds on the sublime and let their bodies change with the season. To have a body is to suffer. Does anybody with a body know peace? How would Mr. Rogers teach that? You don't have to tell us that those of us with a body suffer. That's a lesson that we well know. It doesn't have to be driven into us. And then this one, those who understand this, let me go back to those who understand about fixing their minds with the sublime, detach themselves from all that exists and stop imagining or seeking anything else. Even that word detach is a little harsh for me, but I think that's the process. Our bodhisattva practice is to be totally engaged in the world. And I think that's a nice image. But engaged, you know, is said, you know, engaged, you know, without ego, without separation. As a matter of fact, you can't be totally engaged in your life. You can't bring your whole self into the moment with this ego still intact. Ego has to sort of then be dissolved into you know, the five skandhas. It can't be this fixed self, because the ego's only job is to separate, sometimes in a helpful way, so that you know, for safety and to identify nutrition. But this engagement totally with our life is sort of with dispersion of the ego, without the ego, certainly not attaching to anything that's a good idea. And we kind of know what that's like, you know, when we're totally engaged in our sports, those surfers that I talked about that are engaged in such activity at the surface of the ocean while abiding in the whole ocean, understanding their attachment to the whole ocean. It's not an ego that does that. It's a total engagement in the whole process, the whole works. So yes, there is, detach isn't the worst word there, but my idea of bodhisattva engagement is the whole works, bringing it all there, but without some fixed idea about what this should look like, but just to be engaged with heart and intimacy and non-separation. So this is all part of seeking nothing and fixing our attention on the sublime, on keeping Buddha nature on the front burner, driving our actions, and engaging fully out of that mind. One of our contemporary teachers writes about this. Diane Shoshin Fitzgerald, who teaches in Pembroke, Maine. When Zazen is undertaken to achieve inner peace and reduce outer conflict. No matter how laudable these goals, the activity is inherently dualistic because it relies on a notion of a self that needs improvement. For instance, to become more peaceful, and being judged by another self. For instance, the one or the other self that knows what that improvement would look like. This dualism creates the conditions for an internal war between the self that needs to be more peaceful and the imagined perfectly peaceful self. There might also be a third self engaged in this battle, the trainer self that imposes the regimen for attaining inner peace, like a marathon training coach. The hapless self, the perfect self, and the trainer self all engage in a struggle. A strategy such as this, born in conflict and separation, cannot possibly liberate us from our inner turmoil or guide us through an outer world of strife. So then, what does Zen offer as an alternative? Zen practice invites us to entertain the possibility that peace may not look like the way we imagine it. Instead of trying to create a self that feels and acts more peaceful, Zen asks us to abandon our conception of a self at peace and consider the much more radical possibility that there may be no self that needs to find peace. Anything we imagine as inner peace may be nothing more than what the Diamond Sutra calls a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning. Basically an idea that comes and goes, or a concept that arises and falls. So Zen offers us, you know, when we think of initially, I've got this self that needs peace, Zen might quiet us down a little bit. And we might think, yeah, now I'm aiming towards peace. But the more we practice, we see that Zen is offering us, oh, there isn't a self. And certainly this idea that I've got about peace is not the whole thing, is not the real thing, is not the whole works. And what I find is this big mind that is willing to meet anything that arises, that isn't separate, that's intimate. Having abandoned our idea of peace and our strategies for achieving it, we may find ourselves present to the ever-changing, groundless nature of being alive. I think that's a great line. There's my whole world out there. Ziggy sent me a poem that she wrote that's kind of reminds me of that. I've got this idea of this path that I need to be on and what this path is going to look like. But I'm constantly lost. And then at some point, this groundless nature of being alive has been here all along. And what a journey that is. Having abandoned our idea of peace and our strategies for achieving it, we find ourselves present in the ever-changing, groundless nature of being alive. What could this be like? We don't have a frame of reference for it. It's not about achieving some transcendent experience. Rather, it is about being alive to our life exactly as it is. Experiencing our life not as an observer, but as part of it, as the whole of it. Is this no self, or is this everything is self? It can't be pinned down by words. I think that's what we taste in this practice. That when we suspend that activity of separating the world out into pros and cons and likes and dislikes, when we suspend that, it's without ego. Maybe that's the no-self part, but when we're totally engaged without self, without ego, in this groundless, ever-changing life, in the whole catastrophe, everything is ourself. I think lots of practices tell us that same thing. You know, that kind of message was given when I took the mindfulness-based stress reduction class. Our work, the county wellness program, offered employees that mindfulness class. But it's really kind of the state of the art for people with chronic illnesses and chronic uncomfortable mental states, that to learn mindfulness-based stress reduction. And Bob Stahl taught the class, and he welcomed everybody with, "Yeah, some of you might have some sadness and depression that you want to look at. Some of you might have chronic back pain or recurrent health problems. Welcome. I bring all of that here. But I think at the end of these 6 weeks, you'll be looking at other things in your life. You'll be exploring other things, as well as some of the difficulties that are also part of your life. All of that will be brought here and looked at. I think our practice and the Ornish plan for reducing heart disease, you know, is about yoga and about getting in groups and sharing with each other, so that our world becomes, you know, not a world of I need to recover from heart disease, but a world of I'm engaged in this groundless, ever-changing thing called life that includes heart disease and anxiety and pain and separation from romances that fall apart. But I'm totally engaged in all of these things beyond just the difficulty that I'm focused on now. It expands, and that's why big mind is a pretty good word for this expansiveness that we abide in, that includes everything and doesn't differentiate anything, and from which we can start acting in our life out of that expansiveness and compassion. Maybe we can stop here and walk and sit a little bit more. May our hearts and minds continue to grow and expand so that we are so big that we no longer recognize ourself. And may this compassionate expansion continue endlessly. Save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless.